Welcome to you all, and may I say a special thank you for coming out on such a blistery day. I have a couple of housekeeping things for our internet audience. We welcome you and thank you for joining us. There are two ways in which you can send us questions, and we will relay them to Professor Lewis. One way is right on the media site interface. The second button from the left on the top is a balloon, and if you hit that balloon, it will provide you with access to a question box, and you can send those questions on to us. The second way, should that fail or doesn't appear on your screen or any other problem, please feel free to email M as in Mary, J as in John, K as in Kellogg, I don't know, 38, mjk38@cornell.edu. And we will relay your question at the appropriate time to Professor Lewis. I just want to let everyone know this event is sponsored by Cornell Information Technologies, the University Computer Policy and Law Program in particular. My name is Tracy Matrano, and I direct that program. Thank you to the Computer Science Department, who is entertaining us here today. And we're grateful for your time and space, since I know this is your traditional lecture hour. The College of Engineering Teaching Excellence Institute has been a fantastic contributor in Cornell University Library, especially its undergraduate information competency program. Harry Lewis entered Harvard College in the fall of 1964 and graduated from there in 1968, summa cum laude, in applied mathematics, although his enduring academic love was in computer science, emerging as a discipline at that time. During the Vietnam War, Harry Lewis served for 2 years as a commissioned officer of the U.S. Public Health Service. He spent the academic year of, in 1970-1971 in Europe as a Frederick Sheldon Traveling Fellow of Harvard University. Lewis returned to Harvard to begin graduate study in the fall of 71 and received a Ph.D. in Applied Mathematics in 1974 on the subject of computational unsolvability in mathematical logic. Lewis joined the Harvard faculty in the fall of 74 and became the Gordon McKay Professor of Computer Science in 1981, which he remains to today. In 2003, Harvard honored him with the title of College Professor in recognition of his teaching excellence. He is a fellow of the Berkman Center for Internet Society and Law at Harvard, and that's where I met him a couple of years ago and began reading and appreciating his work on collegiate education and on questions about technology that are raised in law and in our global society. Lewis is the author of 5 books and numerous articles in computer science, and over more than 30 years of teaching, he has helped launch thousands of Harvard undergraduates into careers in computer science. His books about higher education, Excellence Without a Soul, Does Liberal Education Have a Future, was published to much acclaim, in no small part because of its thoughtful, if not provocative, mirror that it places on higher education's challenges in preparing our students to be ethical professionals and good citizens. Together with Hal Abelson and Ken Leedon, Professor Lewis has published Blown to Bits, Your Liberty, Life, Happiness After the Digital Explosion in June of 2008. It addresses the origins and public consequences of the explosion of digital information and will largely be the subject of his talk today. Since 1968, Professor Lewis has been married to Marilyn McGrath. They live in Brookline, Mass., and in Big Fork, Montana, with their 2 daughters, Elizabeth and Anne. When he is not worrying about the state of American education or the unforeseen consequences of digital technology, he worries about the Red Sox, and I empathize with you, much to the chagrin of my children who like the Yankees. We are thrilled to have you here with us today. He genuinely cares about the issues that we care about too, and we value enormously his contributions to these important conversations. Professor Lewis, thank you for joining us, especially on such a snowy Ithaca day.
Up here. And I'm also going to do one thing here that I should have done before. Is that good? Okay. So thanks everybody for turning out. What a great crowd on a snowy afternoon. When I know some of you are going to have to drive home afterwards, and probably just as soon leave earlier. So I really appreciate you, and I really appreciate that nice introduction, Tracy, and the hospitality of everyone that you set me up to talk to today. It's been great. So I want to talk about some things that trouble me. You know, what you're supposed to do when things bother you is to share, right? This is a good mental health exercise. So I'm going to share some of my worries and make some predictions some dilemmas involving privacy and knowledge, and in particular the challenges that they pose for democratic societies, or societies that, when I say free societies, I mean societies that are kind of, whose governance is founded on the notion that people should know a lot, and you become empowered to shape their own future and the future of their children, and through the empowerment that comes with knowledge. The kind of big question, if you had to wrap everything in the talk together, the motivating question is the concern that the explosion of information and its accessibility, which computer and communication sciences have wreaked such a revolution over the past few decades, may result in the restriction of information for various possible reasons. And from various possible sources. It's too embarrassing to people. It's too threatening to governments. It's got too much commercial value to be allowed to roam around in as free a form as it has before. There are various reasons, and we'll touch on some of them. But that's kind of the motivating question. So here's the quick outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about Hillary and the snake. That's Hillary Clinton. And we're going to have a few words to say about Tracy's house. I got some words to say about bees and fertilizer, and the way in which people are like bees and data is like fertilizer, and I don't mean because it makes things grow. I want to talk about the planetary memory, and I'm going to wind up with a discussion of global warming. Now, that, of course, these are merely my tease lines for some more serious set of questions. The prologue is actually about privacy and the extent to which, at the same time as we believe knowledge is empowering, why we have deep fears of knowledge and are actually ambivalent about it spreading around. I want to then pose three questions, and each question is the result of one of these three rubrics, so you'll be able to judge how we're doing on time here and how much of this you'll still have to listen to as you see the 1 through 3 click through. One is the shifting definition of what's public and what's private. Second, how the landscape of who the enemies of privacy are has shifted, and how we have to think about that and what the consequences of that are. The third is whether we're willing to make the trade-off of having more knowledge and less privacy, or would we rather have more privacy and less knowledge, and are we actually going to have to make that choice? And then I want to conclude by talking about whether the communications and computer sciences have a normative dimension of a kind that some areas of science and engineering have long taken for granted that was theirs, and other areas of science and engineering have long claimed was none of their business. So I'll explain all of that as a little more as we go through here. So here's Hillary and the snake, and what I mean by Hillary is Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, who gave a good address, I thought, on internet freedom recently. Some of you probably read about it, or may have listened to it, or read it. And she certainly hit a few of, what I believe are core values, and which I think most computer scientists, information scientists, and so on accept as core values, as well as most people who, kind of have an American view of democratic values believe. More freely information flows, the stronger societies become. Access to information helps citizens hold their own governments accountable, generates new ideas, encourages creativity and entrepreneurship, so it's an economic driver as well as a force for political good, all of which is true. Now, she, in a very small part of the segment, as she was shaking her finger at the Chinese by using this, I think, quite accurate and lofty language, I don't want to belittle it, she also had a few concessions she wanted to make. So we also have to recognize that these technologies are not an unmitigated blessing. Free expression has its limits, at which is exactly what the Chinese always say about us when we shake our finger at them. Well, you don't allow child pornography, and you don't allow libelous speech, and you know, we just have our own cultural definition of what those things are. But we're on the big principle, you know, the Chinese say they're in complete agreement with the Americans, and so that's there she is agreeing with that version of the Chinese position. And then she also talks a little bit about anonymity. Those who use the internet to recruit terrorists or distribute stolen intellectual property cannot divorce their online actions from their real-world identities. This, I thought, was a loophole in her speech large enough to drive a truck through. And actually, I thought a somewhat disturbing clause there at the beginning, because you know those who use the internet to recruit terrorists as one part of the subject here, or distribute stolen intellectual property, that would be you know people like Osama on the one hand, and you know lots of people we know, although you know not you and me, of course, you know are in the loophole category for whom maybe anonymity isn't such a good idea, which means pretty much everybody as far as I can see. So there are some issues, and you know she was asked about this actually, and she says, well, it's complicated, which is you know fair enough, but that's really not what I'm going to talk about. The interesting thing was if you mouse over this is a parenthesis actually, but it was too interesting a parenthesis not to note to you, if you mouse over the video on the state.gov website where this video is, a little menu bar pops up, and it turns out you click on the information thing and it takes you to the Bright Cove website. So Bright Cove turns out to be a site that hosts a video server, and it happens to be the one apparently to which the State Department has subcontracted the job of displaying the internet video of Hillary Clinton proclaiming the importance of information freedom on the internet. And when you look at the privacy policy, it says, we treat IP addresses non-personal information, and we reserve the right to share non-personal information with affiliates and other third parties, which creates the opportunity, as far as I can see, for the government of China to call up Bright Cove and say, could you send us the IP addresses of everybody who watched Hillary Clinton's internet freedom video from inside China? And apparently it's possible to do it. I don't know any. I didn't ask Bright Cove whether they would do such a thing, but they've clearly reserved the right in a clause in their privacy policy to do exactly that. So I'm sure this was not intended and they wouldn't do it and so on. So here's my point about Hillary. This is the snake that I was referring to with Hillary. It's the serpent who tempted Eve to picking the fruit of the tree of knowledge and thereby causing the visitation on humankind of all of the evils to which we are subject. And this is, in fact, where we, according to the Judeo-Christian tradition at least, where we got both knowledge and our sense of shame. The recognition of what we are came as part of the package with you know, lots of suffering. And so there's a, you know, when the serpent said, you know, when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, you know, and then it turned out that, you know, that wasn't exactly what happened with the knowledge once you got it. We've got an early expression here of our ambivalence about whether knowledge is a good thing or not. And the same thing is in Greek mythology. Prometheus, we mostly remember as the guy who went up to Mount Olympus and brought back technology for the benefit of mankind. But we'd like to forget that he actually paid a very severe price for that. Zeus got mad at him, chained him to a mountain and had an eagle eat at his liver. But it wasn't just a personal price that Prometheus paid for this, because Zeus also induced this woman, Pandora, to marry Prometheus's brother, and she then got curious about what was inside that box, and again released on mankind all of these, you know, sins and evils. Another, you know, another old notion that connecting our some of our fears with our hopes for enlightenment. And you know, I want to suggest here that this tension, you know, survives even in the enlightened era, where we believe that knowledge on the whole is good and is empowering and is enlightening and is the, you know, more of it is better. You know, there's a way of reading the First and Fourth Amendments where the First Amendment is a right, is about a human right to spread information as far as you want to spread it, and the Fourth Amendment is about our right to keep it to ourselves, to prevent the spread of information. You know, technically it's only to the government that we're protected, and you know where the edge of that right is in all the way. But this sort of tension between retaining and spreading knowledge is fairly deep in our traditions. Okay, so that's all I mean about that. So here's Tracy's house. You know, I always like to know something about my host. So you know, I looked up Tracy before I came, and I found her address. Now I didn't click on any of these links over here. I didn't even Google Tracy. Okay, I certainly didn't go, you know, looking for her unlisted phone number or get her detailed background report on her. But you know, I went to the white pages and got her address and phone number, and then took a look at see what her house looked like. Does she keep the lawn mown? Yeah, it looks like she's got keeping the lawn thing. You can maybe get a little bit. I tried to zoom in and look in that second story window, but I couldn't quite get there. And, you know, there's a lot of information that is public information. This is not stuff that winds up on the internet that you wish wasn't there. This is information which sort of by statute is public. You know, there's no reason, there's no way that Tracy can prevent the airplane or blimp or whatever it is from flying over her house, satellite, however they take these photos and recording the information. The information that I find really interesting is the information about how many bathrooms she has and how much her house is supposed to be worth. We'll flip through that fairly quickly. But here's some other information which by statute is public. It's Federal Elections Commission campaign contribution data, which was, since the 70s, has been legally public because in the belief that as a matter of having this as a matter of public record is helpful to the progress of the democracy. But you know what that used to mean was, you know, you kind of went down to town hall or maybe to some office in Washington with a single name on a piece of paper, and they went through file cabinets and they sort of gave you back the one datum. You know, now you can sit in Bangladesh and an internet cafe and just mouse over your neighborhood and have the little elephants and donkeys pop up. This is the Huffington Post fundraise website, and see who's given how much money. Tracy hasn't given any money that I can see, but lots of Cornell professors have, and somehow like this is almost monochromatic here. There's like all these blue elephants here. I don't know who Brian Weinsink is, but he seems to be your sole Mike Huckabee supporter in the, you know, on the faculty. The detail up here says 246,480 given by people employed by Cornell University. I actually didn't do the geographical map. You can sort by employer, because that's also data that you have to provide when you accept a political campaign contribution. A little less than 10,000 of the 246,000 was given by 18 people to Republicans, and 236,000 from 314 people to Democrats, mostly to Barack Obama, as far as I can see, one to Hillary Clinton. Okay, well, never mind. It is a weirdly voyeuristic experience to type your own address and mouse over and see what your neighbors are giving. And it's particularly weird when you realize, as I say, that anybody anywhere in the world can do this. And so my question is, you know, is a concept of public information that was devised with every good intention going to shift as with the fact that the printing press is now the personal property of every human being on Earth who has a broadband connection, and that not only the printing press, but the person who with the printing press doesn't even have to worry about how many copies get printed because the access is so ubiquitous. So that's the question. Should public information become less public than it now is? And here's an example of the kind of case that's coming up that is forcing the question. This is a litigation that's taking place right now this comes out of the state of Washington. It's going up to the Supreme Court, where a law was passed that was kind of a quasi-gay marriage law. It's not a gay marriage. It's called everything but marriage. But let's call it gay marriage for the purpose of keeping my explanation brief. And a group of petitioners, these people who Project Marriage Washington and some anonymous petitioners, are got together and filed a petition with the using the ordinary petition process in the state of Washington to have the repeal of that act put on a ballot. And then the group that I will, for sake of abbreviation, call the gay marriage proponents, asked the Secretary of State to give them the names of everybody who signed the petition so that they could post the names of all of the gay marriage opponents on the web, or perhaps so that asked the Secretary of State to do it himself. I don't remember exactly which. So the question is, you know, what about the people who signed this petition to their government following the process of petition, which is actually also in the Fourth Amendment and in other things, and are trying to get this law repealed? It's worked its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Secretary of State said he would do it. This was decided it was a serious privacy issue. The Secretary of State basically said it's a matter of transparency and openness. These are public records. Public records are public records, and if the public wants to see them, they have a right to see them. The gay marriage proponents said at one point that their rationale, they probably wish they hadn't said this, but it was apparently on some website, was they wanted to induce uncomfortable conversations with the people who'd signed the petition. The people who signed the petition believe that they're going to be subject to threats, harassment, and reprisals, and they're being deprived of their political voice because they didn't sign the petition with the intention that this act of petitioning their government was going to be a public act. They thought of it as kind of a form of anonymous political speech. Now, what's happening here, they say, is that their privacy, ordinary people's privacy, is going to be set aside in the same way that politicians' privacy was set aside years ago. And we should be worried about the fact that nobody wants to run for politics unless they are willing to have their private lives quite explicitly on display. And is this a sign that this is now going to happen to anybody involved in the political process, even signing petitions on street corners? So it's a really interesting question. It's a really different question, is there now way too much information for the democratic process to work as it was set up to work as a result of the fact that it so easily spread. By the way, just so as a technical point, petitions are technically not anonymous. You sign a petition, you know, both sides of the argument get to review the lists of names to make sure that there aren't, you know, there's no Mickey Mouse being put on there and so on. It's not anonymous in that sense, but nonetheless, I think most of us who have signed petitions did not expect the names are going to be up on a website. And if you think that merely publishing a name should not be regarded as a threat, you know, consider this lovely website, which I don't suggest you go look at for too long, but this is a website that was put up a few years ago listing the names of doctors who perform abortions with their names crossed out if they'd been killed and grayed out if they'd been wounded. And that website is still up there, and it was the subject of an extensive legal argument, you know, as well. So, you know, this is the extreme case of mere publication of a name being threatening with dripping blood and crossed out names and so on. But the people who put this website up say it's just informational. They're not suggesting that anybody go out and kill anybody. All right. So there's public information. End of question number one. Number two, I want to talk about bees and fertilizer or the enemies of privacy. So I think we've gone through, whether you think privacy is a good idea or not, I think we've gone through there are four categories of enemies of privacy. The original enemy of privacy, as we understood it, those of my age, and I guess people still read 1984 in school, is you worry about the eye of the government, right? The government was the enemy, and this is still something that people are reasonably worried about. This was a story from last week or 2 weeks ago or something like that. You know, the FBI wants to, would be very pleased if Congress would legislate that internet service providers record all of the websites that their customers visit. Not clear exactly what the FBI means by that, whether it's just the IP address or the entire URL that is sent to the server. But so there's other stuff going on. There's some nice corporate cooperation with the government's surveillance wishes. This is one that I like. This is Chris Segoyan's website, which has one of these wonderful titles, Slight Paranoia. Chris is actually quite a reasonable guy, but he is slightly paranoid. But sometimes the paranoia is actually worthwhile. So Sprint Nextel provided law enforcement agencies. Any of you a Sprint Nextel mobile phone service provider? Anybody have Sprint? Nobody in this room? Maybe there's no service, Sprint service in Ithaca. Well, those of you who do, provided law enforcement with its customers' GPS location over 8 million times between September 2008 and October 2009. This massive disclosure of sensitive computer information was possible due to a rollout by Sprint of a new special web portal for law enforcement officers. Sprint made it easy for law enforcement just to go to the web and find out, I'm sorry to tell you, where your phone was. And in an earlier case, when the government was challenged about whether this was a Fourth Amendment violation or anything like that, one of the U.S. attorneys in the Eastern District of New York said, anybody who does not wish to disclose his movements to the government need not use a cellular telephone. What are you complaining about, right? It's your personal agency. If you use a cellular telephone and you leave it on and you use GPS, you know, and you don't like the government knowing it, you have a way out of it. So that's the 1984 thing. There's actually a case right now in the courts about whether the government needs a warrant even to get the cell phone tracking information. So this is something. Well, anyway, this is all continuing. This is all, again, this is February 12th. This is all quite current. But that's now, you know, over the last while, and you can see in some of those examples, the government involvement is now mixed up with the corporate involvement. The second threat, of course, is what the information that is in the possession of the corporations. These are all mostly internet corporations. The Google brain contains untold amounts of information about people. We'll come back and talk to that. But you know, anybody you do commerce with or any of the internet service providers or your services have lots of information. What struck me as I was doing this talk, writing up this talk last week, was it's not just the digital companies that are using digital technologies to collect information about us. So here was my experience. I was in the Toyota dealer getting a software patch for my brakes last week. So, you know, a weird concept, you know, yeah, what time do you want to do, you know, labor and so on and so forth. And you bring the thing up and they like plug something in and they load some new bits into the car and then they wash it for you, you know, because that's their... So while I was pleased to discover that they had a Wi-Fi in the waiting area for the service, and all of a sudden this thing pops up on my screen. This site is blocked by Herb Chambers Company Security Service. This event has been logged. So Herb Chambers Toyota knows that I was trying to go to Wikipedia.org to look up what library science technically meant because I was preparing this talk. Now, what is my Toyota dealer going to do with my web browsing habits? And yes, and why do they want to block my access to Wikipedia? Well, look, this is funny only because it's so lame, right? But, you know, we all know that any aspect of computer technology that's lame today will work seamlessly and invisibly tomorrow, right? So there was some damned I agree box, and I guess I agreed that, you know, Herb Chambers can have my firstborn son or something. You know, who knows what was in the I agree, but I apparently agreed that they can log my internet browsing habits. There's geolocation data that's of great interest with associated with advertising. Again, we all know that if you see an advertisement, it's got some local references because the advertiser or the whoever's hosting, you know, serving the ads, knows your IP address and can figure out where that is. So when I was in Montana last summer at the home that Tracy mentioned, and I saw this Kalispell mom lost 47 pounds following one rule ad, you know, I laughed and went on. But in spite of that this couldn't possibly have anything to do with me. I mean, how would they know I'm overweight, for example? This woman doesn't look anything like me. When I got on the plane the next morning and came back and turned on my computer again, and there she was again, the same 47 pounds, right? Okay. But now she was in Brighton, Massachusetts, rather than Kalispell, Montana. And, you know, so again, this is funny only because it's, you know, so lame. But I'd like you to consider the following experiment, which was done by Jeremy Bailenson at Stanford. Does anybody know this work? This is really cool and really creepy. So Jeremy Bailenson in 2004 got a bunch of people, you know, some subjects, one at a time, into his lab and showed them pictures of Bush and Kerry and asked them who they would vote for, and they got exactly the expected results, you know, 52 Bush and 48 Kerry or 51, 49 or something, very close to the actual results of the election. And then he brought in some other people and showed them, instead of Bush and Kerry, who these are not, but the actual Bush and the actual Kerry, because who these people are, what happened is, here's what he did. He showed to one group, he showed the actual Kerry and a version of George Bush that had been morphed slightly with their own face, the subject's own face. So there was a camera on the subject. And they just mixed in, he said, using a very stupid algorithm. It's just pixel averaging, nothing more complicated than that. A little bit of, actually apparently 40%, but apparently you actually have to morph quite a bit for it to, before you notice it, 40% of their own face. And in control group, he showed the actual Bush and a group that got 40% of their own face morphed in with Kerry. And it didn't matter who they were, male, female, Asian, black, doesn't matter. It was just as the group. And these election results swung wildly. All of a sudden, Bush wins by 10 points with the first group, and Kerry wins by about 5 points in the second group. Okay, so, and not one person noticed that it wasn't the actual George Bush or the actual George Kerry in one of the two images they were seeing. Everybody understand how this worked? Okay. So, guess what the advertisers are going to want to do? Okay? These people. Guess what they're going to want to do? They don't want to show me Kalispell Mom. They want to show me Kalispell Mom with 40% of my own face blocked in. I mean, I'm sure they're out there trying to figure out how to do it now. I mean, already there are video ads in department stores that have cameras on them and adjust, you know, show different ads to black people than to white people because they know that they won't buy the same cosmetics. That happens already, but I don't know of anybody who's doing anything this sneaky. Okay, so there we are. Okay. You don't believe that result? Okay, well, I don't know. He's a respectable guy. I don't have no reason to think that he falsified his data. But you can go to his website and get the paper.
I actually believe in the content convention, it is right political awareness whatsoever in order to have them shift.
Well, that's your assertion, and you know, I don't think this is a guy who's got any agenda here. It's just, as far as I know, that's what, yeah. He's at Stanford. I don't know. He's got to be smart, right? Okay. Everybody knows how much Google knows about us. There are these quite weird phenomena about what Google knows about us as a population and is willing to tell us as a population. You've all seen Google Trends, but this is if you don't know how weird it is to understand how American society actually works, you should try this. Actually, you should try this not typing how do I get my wife and how do I get my husband, but how do I get my boyfriend and how do I get my girlfriend. But this is a family audience that I'm addressing here today, so I did it with wife and husband, and Google will make helpful suggestions. So this part of the talk is about suggestions. Okay, are you ready? Okay, what do you think the number one thing that husbands ask Google how to get their wife to do is? No, don't tell me. You'll embarrass yourself. So the number one thing that men ask Google how to get their wife to do is to swing. And the number one thing that wives ask how to get their husbands to do is to get my husband to fall in love with me. Isn't this sad? This is a welcome to America. This is our, you know, and I can't make any apologies for my sex. We are what we are, but there we are. How do I get my wife in the mood? How do I get my husband back? How do I get my wife to shave? How do I get my wife, the husband, to help around the house? This is at least practical, right? Okay. How do I get my wife to want me? How do I get my husband to notice me? Everybody wants their spouse to lose weight, but you know, how do I get my wife back? How do I get my husband to move out? These are presumably for the women who've tried 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and failed, right? How do I get my wife to sleep with me? How do I get my husband to talk to me? It's amazing stuff. How do I get my wife to fall in love with me again? How do I get my husband to appreciate me? Well, that's okay. How do I get my wife to fall in love with me again? How do I get my husband to love me again? That's good. And how do I get my wife pregnant? How do I get my husband to stop drinking? Well, these two people really need to talk to each other. Right? There may be some correlation there. Okay, this is very funny, but it's a reminder that, you know, to a large degree, you know, what you and I think doesn't matter in terms of what information Google gives us when we use it as a search engine, right? Google is in business to make money, and its suggestions are whether they be search suggestions or anything else, are tiered to, you know, geared to what most people want most of the time. That's the way Google makes its money. So we have this tyranny of the majority problem. But Google would like to get past that, of course. I'm going to skip this one. This is Spears. Okay. So that was just, you know, if you ask for Spears, you get back what most people want, which is Britney Spears, not Spears. But anyway, I'm running a little late here, so I'm going to try to speed up. Google, of course, would like to personalize your searches, which it needs to know more about who you are. So it invites you to create a Google account and to leave it on so it can collect your search history and give you searches that you actually want. Now, were it not for the fact that I never actually even once Googled, you know, how do I get my wife to do anything, you know, I might be worried that some of those suggestions were actually geared to my particular interest. But who knows, maybe they were, because they were somehow informed by my web search history, which is entirely possible. So Google tries to make this attractive to induce us to surrender more information about themselves so that it can make better and more appropriate suggestions for us, so we'll use Google more and not switch to any of its competitors and so on. That's the nature of the economy of the, you know, of the search business, and they're quite explicit about this. They want to organize the world's information, make it universally accessible and useful. Well, actually, my personal search history, I don't actually want to be universally accessible. And Sergey says the perfect search engine would understand exactly what you mean and give back exactly what you want. And to that end, of course, they have an incentive to try to collect and maintain information about us, which is, of course, became quite an issue, this was the first moment, the time that a lot of people suddenly realize how much information they have about it and what happens if they press the wrong button. Here, the wrong ending was like the "let's turn this on" button, not anything else, where they decided that a clever way to get themselves to be the world's largest social network overnight would be just take everybody's address book and use email address book and use that as the links in the in the social network. No setup needed. And to make the startup experience easier, that's the only reason why we're doing it this way. So it's not like we suddenly want to have a social network of, you know, 500 million people, you know, under our control tomorrow. We're doing this to make life easier for you. Privacy, corporate privacy. Remember, this is the first of four steps on the privacy front. You can create privacy laws. There's a big new one in Massachusetts that is going to come into effect on Monday. You can petition the Federal Trade Commission when it's the kind of company that is involved in money-making activities. This is the Electronic Privacy Information Center's complaint to the Federal Trade Commission about the Google Buzz business. You can use the normal processes of government, of legislation and government, to help control the data buildup in corporate hands. But I want to note here that the difference with the government thing is that here it's all in an interest of being helpful to us, and that there's a way in which the suggestion technology is actually encouraging us, you know, not to have control of our lives. The Google Buzz is the best example, in that sense. That, you know, I think a good principle that people should learn is that if they want to build up a social network, they should build it up themselves and not expect anybody else to build it up for them. So the more helpful that the corporate world tries to be to us, the more we're surrendering control of our personal agency in lots of these affairs to others whose interests are not necessarily aligned with ours. And in many of these cases, you know, there is no government agency to stand on our side with privacy. You know, in Europe there might be, but, you know, the American view on the, you know, privacy issue has been always very secondary to the First Amendment, freedom of information issues. And so, you know, I concluded that we've got the wrong metaphor here if we think about the Big Brother as in the government. We shouldn't forget about that as we, you know, think about the classic wonderful case last week of the student with the laptop cams, the school district who decided to turn on the webcams on cameras so they could find where the stolen computers were. At least that's what they said. But it's not, you know, the government, the Big Brother we need to worry about. It's Google, the helicopter parent, right? It's the helpful Google who gathers all of this information around and gives us helpful suggestions all the time about who our friends should be and how, you know, what we should mean when we search for things, which websites are more important to us, and all the rest of that. There is a bleeding process of personal agency that's going on here, which I think is worrisome. And we have no standards about how to think about this, as far as I can see. You know, I thought about Asimov, who created laws for what he thought were robots were going to be. And he has these wonderful, you know, three principles of robotics, which I think everybody would still agree with, but they're totally irrelevant to this kind of automation, right? They weren't designed for the notion that the Google brain was the big robot that was going to be manipulating us while being helpful to us at the same time. Okay. Third threat is guess who? It's you and me. We have met the enemy and he is us. This is, you know, the way we give away information very, you know, we give away our, you know, how much bicarbonate of soda and, you know, what size prophylactics we use so that we can get 25 cents off on a bag of potato chips, right, by using the supermarket loyalty card. You know, we give away geographical information for the fun of giving it away. My university actually joined with Foursquare. This is a service where you can go around and check in various places and report where you are. We give away information. Blippi? Who's on Blippi? Anybody on Blippi? Oh, you people at Cornell are so uncool. Everybody, everybody at Harvard's on Blippi. Not a single Blippi person here. Yeah, this is the hinterlands out here, all right. Blippi is this social networking site that kind of wires your credit card directly to your Twitter account, right? You just you swipe your credit card, and all your friends find out what you bought and where you bought it instantly. Is that cool or what? Are we all going to run out? They should pay me, you know, to be a pitchman for Blippi. What? What? Are you kidding? There are thousands of people joining Blippi for the joy of giving information away, and presumably for the joy of finding out what other people are like them are buying and where they're buying it. Right? So that's our own self-inflicted injuries, and I don't want to analyze them anymore because I want to move quickly to threat number four, which is the hive or the mob or whatever you want to call it when a group of autonomous human beings of no special status in life get together and cooperate in a way that enables them to produce a large artifact, like Wikipedia is always the best case that people cite. But I want to talk about the downsides of this, because this is the one that I'm finally going to get to my second question here in a few moments. Think of this example. So you can now buy for $289, I think it is, a license camera, a license plate reading camera that will capture license plates at up to 90 miles an hour. You just go on the web and you can buy one, okay? And you can like set it up on the tree next to your street, and you can just start logging the license plate numbers of all of the cars that are driving down the street. And everybody can do this. If I managed to sell you guys all on the idea of doing this, we could start accumulating a pretty nice collection of license plate numbers and timestamps and locations, and you know, make some correlations between it. And so, of course, it wouldn't tell us who was in any of those cars or even who any of those cars belonged to, because license plate data is not public information. You know, unless of course you're me and you, like an idiot, put your initials on your license plate and also tell people which bars you like to go to in Western Montana. But you know, for normal people, you know, who don't do that, that's anonymous data. But you know, there are ways once the database starts building up that you could do it. Here's one thing you could do if you were if you managed a supermarket, if you owned a mall, for example. You know, you could clock when people went in and out of the parking lot and correlate it with when people make purchases. Or maybe you just link it to your Blippi feed or something like this. And anyway, you know, and you can probably make some inferences about whose credit card corresponded in time over a course of 6 months with which license plate number going into the parking lot. And you could start to build up a large database of who the license plate number owners are. Now, maybe that's not a terrible thing. Well, let's talk about the example I mentioned before about faces. You know, how useful would a big catalog of everybody's face attached to their name be? Well, I bet some people could think a lot about how useful a big public directory of faces and names might be. Maybe those advertisers that I mentioned earlier. Facebook actually already has a pretty good inventory of faces and names, and it'll gladly use automated photo tagging technology to do that. You know, there are cameras now that once it recognizes that the same face keeps turning up in your photos, will ask you to type in the name of the person so that it can tag your photos for you automatically when you upload them to Picasa or whatever. You know, there are all kinds of ways you can just ask people, put the faces up on the web and ask people to identify them if you wanted to do that. If you're a authoritarian figure, this has been done for a while. This was a pot-smoking protest at the University of Colorado, and the police just put some of the faces of the pot smokers up on the web and asked the University of Colorado student body to help identify them. The same technique that was used by the government of Iran in the aftermath of the posters, they just started putting pictures up on the web and circling the faces and say, who's this person? You know, we want to throw him in jail, and helpful fellow citizens, you know, would identify them. You may be able to bribe people with very small rewards. I don't know, you could put up an Amazon Turk thing. You know what Amazon Turk is? This is a, you know, this is where for a penny people will perform stupid repetitive tasks that computers ought to perform but are too stupid to today. You know, like deciding which furniture category various, you know, things belong to. So, you know, if you do this, you get one penny. I don't know whether it's up. I don't know, the one penny I think was on the previous slide, but there are a lot of these. Yeah, there we are. One penny per identification. People will do tasks that are fairly mindless for very little money. There are all kinds of ways to induce people to think. Here's, you know, there's another database we might try to accumulate. You know, images of people walking. Gait is a good identifier, a good identifying biometric. Maybe we can get that. It would certainly be handy for police purposes. This is a surveillance camera video of a sexual assault that happened near Boston, where the party is completely obscured, except you can see he's got a quite distinctive and unusual limp, and it would be very useful to the authorities to have a gait catalog. But there are limits on what the government can do, but the government actually doesn't have any limits on what it can buy from the public if some corporation can somehow bribe individuals into contributing a Wikipedia database of personally identified gates or license plates or images. The government can, within Fourth Amendment rules, just buy it. So, you know, a lot of people will contribute to projects like this just for the fun of doing it. We like generating information, and it requires relatively modest bribes to get us to do it. You know, there are people spend lots of time typing in dollar bill numbers at their, you know, one of the things the internet has informed all of us about, this will track where your dollar bill has been, you know, because other people have contributed their sightings of the same dollar bill. One of the things the internet has taught us is that there are incredible numbers of people with incredible amounts of time on their hands who are willing to waste it. And, you know, photo tagging might be something I'd be able to do. So I just want to, you know, remember that the more freely information flows, the stronger societies become. Access to information helps citizens own their governments accountable, generates new ideas, encourages creativity and entrepreneurship, but it also has some scary side effects. So my second question, and here is the fertilizer question, is should data be like fertilizer? And I don't mean that it helps things grow, and I don't mean that it smells bad. I mean that we actually need to restrict whether people have it at all. Right? Fertilizer has the property, nitrate fertilizer, that you can't own it anymore because of the possibility that it can be in sufficiently large quantities be used for harmful purposes, that if a private individual wants to buy a bag of nitrate fertilizer, the person who sells it to them has to, they have to provide identification. You have to hold it available for inspection. It has to be stored in a secure location. There's all kinds of restrictions on even relatively small purchases of fertilizer because of the possibility of aggregating it. And the question is, you know, should there be any knowledge, an accumulated database, which a collection of private individuals without, either corporate, so there's no trade issue here, or government interest directly, which citizens should actually be prohibited from having. You know, you can, you know, if you have more than 100 license plate numbers in your possession, then you have to register with the government because you must be about to do something bad. Or if you have more than 1,000 tagged facial photographs, the state has an interest in this. The notion of prohibited government, you know, government prohibited information ownership, you know, while it certainly exists in some sectors, you know, about data leakage or data leakage laws, but this is something different. This is, we now have the opportunity to create enormous private databases by cooperation. Okay. Final thing. I'll be sure to leave some time for questions here. The planetary memory or sacrificing privacy for knowledge. And the planetary memory comes from this remarkable quotation from H.G. Wells in 1937. And if you've never seen this, I just want to read it to you because it's so stunning when you read it. He said in 1937, there is no practical obstacle whatever now to the creation of an efficient index to all human knowledge, ideas, and achievements. To the creation, that is, of a complete planetary memory for all mankind. And not simply an index. The direct reproduction of the thing itself can be summoned to any properly prepared spot. Wow. What's he talking about? Right? This is Google, right? This is like, you know, it's this huge index of everything. And, you know, and you click on it and all of a sudden you've got it. This in itself is a factor of tremendous significance. It foreshadows a real intellectual unification of our race. The whole human memory can be, and probably in a short time will be, made accessible to every individual. Well, he was a little wrong on the timing. And microfilm, which was the technology that he actually had in mind, turned out to have some issues that made it actually, you know, impossible. But what a stunning, you know, prognostication. But we are getting there. And we're, you know, maybe about to get there with Google Books, depending on what happens in court, which is, I think Google would like to be a planetary memory of all of the world's literature held in private hands, which probably is not what H.G. Wells thought of. So I don't know if you ever use Google Books. You know, it's interesting magazines and classics. And then when I did it anyway, it showed you a random subject, human locomotion. And I looked at that and I said, random subject, human locomotion. Like, you don't think they remembered that I'd like tried to grab a slide of people walking, because I had this other part of the talk where I was working on earlier about gait, and that's how, when I moved over to Google Books, which I thought of as a different department of Google, you know, that they said, here's a guy who's weird about people walking, let's offer him some, if that's what, you know, if that's what he gets off on, we'll give him a lot of choices on that, you know, animals in motion, you know. Anyway, so the question here is, will reading cease to be a private activity? And this is, I think, the big, in my mind, one of the reasons why I've been very worried about the Google book settlement, is that this notion of a digital library is a huge metaphor failure, because Google is not a library, okay? Libraries are, by law, in most states, this happens to be the Michigan law, prohibited from releasing or disclosing library records, also as a matter of professional ethics of the librarian profession. And everything that Google is, everything that libraries are prohibited from do, Google is going to be required to do, okay? So, you know, the settlement prose goes on forever, but you know, you go to the part about university libraries, it says the library keeps track of and reports all uses of the books, right? You know, everything that may not be disclosed in a library must be disclosed in terms of, you know, potentially, again, it's hard to know whether much of this will actually come to pass, but not just what books you're reading, what day you read them on, but which pages you kept on going back to, and you know everything, how much time you spent on every page. This, of course, is all useful information that can be monetized in various ways, and which Google will presumably try to do to, you know, gain something back from its enormous investment. So, you know, the Copyright Act, which is the way this issue has worked its way into the court system and up onto the desk of Judge Chin, you know, which was an act for the encouragement of learning, is now going to turn into an act that makes it impossible to learn unless you're willing to tell Google who you are and what you're learning and allow it to draw some inferences about why. So there are the three questions. Should public information be less private? Should there be any prohibited knowledge? And, you know, will reading cease to be a private activity? Now my conclusion. Well, you know, one word on, you know, does privacy matter? I believe it does, because I believe privacy is a socially progressive force. Well, I'll skip my argument here, and we can talk about it in the question period if anybody wants to raise that point. So let me go straight to global warming. And the reason I mention global warming is because I got this email from a recent alum from Harvard with whom I was discussing something else, and I asked him about his undergraduate education, and he said, that the thing he liked about his major was I thought there was usually a pretty clear normative argument running through the courses I took. Now, I don't know what departments you all teach in and where you are, but I don't think there are a lot of Harvard majors where this is the thing that a student would say was good about it. And this student's major was environmental science and public policy. And when he said that, I understood what he was saying, right? The faculty, whether they were kind of oceanographers or whether they were, chemical engineers or whoever he was taking courses from, kind of none of them actually thought that it would be better if the Earth got a whole lot hotter than it is, right? There was a sense there that what the knowledge that the student was getting and the knowledge that the faculty was teaching was in service of a larger end, and larger end was to prevent the Earth from overheating and various other environmental traumas to the Earth. And it got me thinking that there are normative and non-normative disciplines in universities. The non-normative disciplines, if you're an archaeologist, you probably don't have, you're not making judgments. If you're a mathematician, I would argue, your discipline is morally neutral. And the way we appoint and promote mathematicians, this is the purest form of a non-normative field. If you're a linguist, it depends. If you're a historical linguist, if you're like studying Indo-European roots or something like that, I think that's probably non-normative. If you're the physics, you could have some arguments. But I think string theorists would probably say the chips are going to fall where they may, and what I'm doing, I'm not doing in the hopes that I'm going to make the world a better place because I discover one thing or another about the truth of string theory. On the other hand, there are normative disciplines. Political science, I think, is a normative discipline. It may not be a science, but it's certainly normative. I think most parts of engineering consider that they're in business to improve human welfare. Certainly bioengineering. I think most parts of philosophy anyway probably do, and the environmental science guy that I mentioned. And so the question is, where does computer science go on this? And I think classically, computer science as defined as, it was defined many years ago as principally the study of algorithms and then the study of software and the study of machine architectures and various other things. I think we've always thought of it as pretty clearly being over on the other side of the ledger. And, while there is this other area, which has an interesting split here at Cornell with computer science and information. So, information scientists, these guys are all civil libertarians, right? As far as I know, I hope they are. I hope they're not like thinking, censorship is good and we're going to make sure that nobody sees stuff they shouldn't see. I don't think that's my understanding of what the field is, but that's why I was trying unsuccessfully to get to the Wikipedia page to make sure that I was right on that. And, I think in the communications revolution, computer science kind of has to move over here. It has to acknowledge that it belongs increasingly on the other side of the ledger, where merged in with communication science. And the reason is that privacy, to go back to the title of my talk, is actually tied up with all of the other normative principles of knowledge, let's call them, that we in democratic societies believe are important. Free speech, accountability of government, the things that Hillary Clinton talked about. Scientific rationality is another normative thing of information. And privacy, of which the computer science world and the communications science world are the enablers or the disablers, is kind of, it puts us more in the categories of the bioengineers and the environmental scientists, I think, than we used to be, and we should acknowledge that. Thank you. So, sorry I was a little long, but I'd be delighted to answer any questions, virtual or real, although those who ask questions virtually, have to know that Herb Chambers Toyota may know you asked me the question. Disagreements.
Besides, people actually reacting to anything totally crazy that they do. But I just wanted to ask you, like, what you think of how, like, in the beginning of, say, Facebook, where you have these private networks, people are more than willing to share probably very identifiable information.
Right.
They know, even though these people are my friends, it's a closed network.
Right.
What do you see the potential in the future of internet apps where they're tracking all your stuff? Even if they try to keep it slightly private, all it takes is one malicious person in that network to just take all your stuff, like, for instance, now, if someone were to be able to get into every Facebook network, they could take every, like,
So I'm sorry. So the question, just to repeat it, because I assume that the audience, that no one else who's remote can hear it. Question was about privacy of things like Facebook, and the question is, when you say a malicious person breaking an understanding of privacy, are you talking about what we used to call a hacker, but which I try to keep that term pure?
Yes and no. I mean, I guess
cracker. Or are you talking about just another person in the social network who decides to publish all of your friends, even though you thought your social network was private?
Someone wants to map out the networks of every college. If they had one EQ email address and each of them, they get one person, they could theoretically do that.
Well, this is one of these, I think this is a question where, we're going to have to see. My guess is that no one will think about the possibilities until there's some catastrophic failure, of some privacy, some understanding of privacy. You're kind of asking a question, is it possible? Yes. Is it going to happen? I don't know.
It's kind of the same thing as the government. When someone really steps over the line, that's when people react.
When someone really steps over the line, as they did with Google Buzz, I mean, I think that Google, I love Google. My daughter works at Google. One of my students was the first person that Larry and Sergey hired. I think it's a fabulous company. I think it's done enormous amounts for society. I don't hate Google, but it's a love relationship that's got the love hate component, aspect to it. I hope they are doing what Mr. Toyota says he's doing, and which is taking his company back and rethinking how the heck did we make this mistake? What ever possessed us to think that this was a bright idea and to release this as a product without realizing that this was a real violation of privacy, because they missed something that, unfortunately for them, I think, I hope Judge Chin knows about Google Buzz, because it really calls into question their loyalty to the notion of privacy, insofar as they claim that the information they collect about book reading is going to be private. Yeah?
So how much do you think it's a person's responsibility to take their privacy into their own hands? For Google Buzz, for example, when they first show you the science screen, you could, in theory, uncheck everybody you didn't want to be friends with, or...
Right. Well, the question is how much is this... everybody's personal responsibility, and there shouldn't be, I assume where you're going with it is, it's a free market, nobody has to join.
I'm just wondering, because it seems like there have been instances with Facebook as well where they give you, options to either opt out or opt in, and people say, well, the default was bad, and so if I don't make any choice, that's bad.
Right.
Do you think that's where we should go? Should we have a huge list of checkboxes to say, well, I want this to be private, this to be not private, what happens if people don't use them?
I think there should be very loud disclosure. I think these I agree boxes are insane. I want the lawyers who write these contracts all to be disbarred, right? Because we all know nobody reads them. Half of them say, as the last item you agree to, we, the company, can change this policy anytime we want and just post it on our website without even telling you that we've updated it. They are completely insane. No, I want, when you, click, I want a kind of, notice in very simple layman's language about what you're giving away and what you're not giving away, because the technology is so much more part of everyday life that you agree to it, or if you don't want the government to know your location, just don't carry a cell phone kind of stuff, is no longer an adequate answer, in my view. So it has to be, you know, very loud disclosure, and as you know, and but that means then that you do need a regulatory agency. You know, I don't like big government. I don't like regulation. I'm a free market capitalist. I'm all of those things. But you know, if you have regulations, then you have to have somebody to enforce the regulations, because the monetary value of this information is so extraordinarily high. It's so extraordinarily high that, you know, that everybody's going to read the regulations and, you know, try to figure out how to get around them. I also believe, because that's so hard, that education is really, really, really important. You know, people have to be taught not to do things just because it's easy and they see everybody else doing them and they haven't been able to see any visible harm. Now, I don't know exactly where, at what stage in human development, you know, childhood development, or, you know, that education has to happen. And, you know, it runs the risk of, you know, putting us all in this, you know, finger-shaking, nannying role, but it's perfectly clear that people aren't thinking through the consequences of what they're doing. Yes?
The things that we use the internet for to require authentication, like banking and things like that.
Right.
And the things that we use the internet for that we might wish to have privacy about can actually, do you think that they're so fundamentally opposed that they can't really coexist on the same network, or do you see that they actually can?
No, I think they can exist. I think there are a combination of technological and disclosure solutions to these problems, but they're fighting enormous financial disincentives. That's the problem. The question, I'm sorry, was the necessary utilities, banking and so on, where we give up information, and the demands for privacy, are they fundamentally inconsistent and should, like, we somehow separate them into different networks or something like that? Yes, sir.
I was going to say, it's a fact that the law often lags behind technology. And one of my questions is, who should the policy making be left up to? Specifically, what can we do as computer scientists to kind of prevent or, you know, not have these type of privacy violations happen?
Right. So the question says, you know, law always lags behind technology, which is true. And it is actually a good thing, because when law gets actually out ahead of technology, it tends to stifle innovation. But the problem is that technological cycles are now way shorter than legal cycles, right? It's not just a lag time. It's just like by the time the law tries to catch up, the blippy thing is already yesterday. And, you know, there's something else that's, that's replaced it. And the question was, what can the computer scientists do? You know, I think the computer scientists actually ought to get more involved in, you know, lobbying and petitioning and learning their congressman's name, so congresspeople's names, so they can call them up and so on. The very kinds of things that the environmental scientists do. And it may not be a welcome role, because, the not all scientists love being the center of media attention or of engaging in the political process, because they went into science in some way because of its purity. But I think the truth of the matter is that computer and communication sciences are, you know, out of the Garden of Eden now. We've got to recognize what it is that we've wrought and, you know, engage its social consequences more. Yes?
Do you think our definition of what is private and what's not is absolute, or is it tied to technology? Because, you know, like the petitions example I mentioned previously, that information was public, but nobody thought they can actually aggregate that information and publish it. But now we have computation power.
Right. Yeah. Is private and public an absolute? And, you know, it's not, it's a very hard, it's a distinction that's fraught with so many paradoxes that it really requires a kind of long essay, not a 2-second answer. But, you know, there are these very troubling things that where there are well-intentioned efforts to create technological privacy and, you know, enhancements, they often don't work because of the computational power. I mean, The best example of this was the thing that some of Hal Abelson's students did at MIT, where they took the social network of a bunch of people who had not disclosed in the Facebook checkoffs what their sexual orientation was, and determined their sexual orientation with very high reliability by looking at the social networks of their friends, which was public information. So it turns out, you know, guess what? Gay people have a lot of gay friends, or something like that. It was something a little more sophisticated than that. That would be the very stupid version of the algorithm. So, you know, the notion, so this goes back to the question that the gentleman over here asked, you know, sort of, well, you know, if you give me control over my information, isn't that the right way to go? And we educate people to have control. Well, it turns out, even if I do all the right things in terms of the checkboxes and protecting my privacy, if I want to be part of a social network, if I want to carry a cell phone, if I want to do lots of other things, you know, it may be possible to infer things about me anyway, which I would prefer to be private. Okay, I probably should answer one more question. How about in the back? Isn't that, we're about done, aren't we?
Yeah.
So let me last question, you in the back. I didn't hear the first part.
Okay. I'm talking about the case that Google just lost in Italy regarding with Down syndrome, who had a video of him being bullied posted on the internet. And so Google found sort of guilty of violating his child's privacy, even though he had nothing to do with the video, merely by the fact that the video was up for 2 months before it was down. So this does contribute to the fact that it's very possible to violate someone else's privacy.
Yeah. So the question is about intermediary liability, is I think what the technical term would be. There's a case in Italy where a YouTube video went up and people didn't like it and Google didn't take it down and so on. And here the European standards and the U.S. standards as they exist now are pretty drastically different because Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, completely absolves the intermediaries, Google or whatnot, from a lot of liability for stuff that other people post, as long as they didn't post it themselves. And the Europeans who have a stronger view of privacy than the U.S. does, have taken Google to task for this, not just in this one Italian case that you mentioned, but in a in a number of others. So you're asking me for my expert legal opinion. You're asking me for my amateur something or other. I mean,
whatever you feel comfortable.
Okay.
Hours after they were notified about it.
Yeah, well, I'm not gonna make a judgment about the Google case because I don't know the facts about it. My inclination on all of these things, I hate to say, but I think it's really true, is I consider the free speech value so important and the empowering aspect of these information portals with their volunteer contributions to be so high, and I'm such a kind of lunatic First Amendment libertarian that I think we've got to get used to stuff going up on the web that we don't like. Now, there are, that's as simple a question as I can get, and happily I neither have to defend it nor explain where my limits would be, and you don't have to challenge me with horrible test cases about, What if my mother was a family service doctor who provided some services and that of the kind that we saw on that website and all of these other kinds of things. But my worry, frankly, is that the law, which lags the technology, will react to some of these bad cases and make some bad laws that will tweaked to serve not only the interests of protecting people in unconstitutionally limiting ways, but will also be tweaked to serve the commercial interests of the people who give lots of money to the people who make the laws, right? So remember, the forces for restricting information are not only the forces of morality and protecting and reputation protecting and all the rest of that, but they are the people who own intellectual property who would be, I'm sure, right in there supporting the FBI in its request to Congress that the ISPs should collect lots of information about what's flowing through the internet. So I see a conjunction of forces there that I fear is going to result as to, now to end finally with the question, you know, the question that I posed at the beginning, that our various forms of fear will conspire to restrict the flow of information in this enormously empowering medium that we've created. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.